Hello and welcome to a special edition of Irreverent Testimony, the political podcast by and for millennials and Gen Xers with a left-leaning bent, to say the least. Very happy to have a very special guest today, all the way from San Francisco, Dr. Rebecca Gordon, who is a professor of ethics at the University of San Francisco, and is also a published author of some great works, including a book that she released recently about the war on terror and torture called A Nation of Cowards, Torture in the Post-9/11 United States, which, of course, is highly recommended. And in 2006, Torture Comes Out of the Closet, in Peace Review, a journal of social science. That was from the journal Social Science. And before that has published some works based on her work in Nicaragua and also in South Africa, doing some philanthropic work down there. We are very, very excited and delighted to have you on. Dr. Gordon, thank you so much.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. Let me just say, I think you looked at an elderly website because although I loved the title, A Nation of Cowards, my publisher thought that was a little over the top. And so we actually went with Mainstreaming Torture. So that's the actual name of the book.
Ah, right, right. That does ring a bell better. But I don't mind the provocative title at all. I'm with you in terms of getting right to the point and sparing no expense. Because this is the other side that always is decrying the PC age. So why should we be PC, right?
Absolutely right. Call it what it is.
Absolutely. As usual, I'm Travis.
I'm Rachel.
And we're gonna jump right into it here. Professor Gordon, what caught my eye was I am an avid reader of Professor Juan Cole's newsletter, and he had included a recent article that you had just published about the massive state of corruption and how a lot of the political process and the powers that be in this country. Of course, this all ties into the 1% and the Koch brothers and the military-industrial complex, how the game has really sort of been rigged, and we either lose sight of that or forget about it, or it gets sort of lost in the wash, or a lot of the media sort of fudges over it and pretends it doesn't exist. But your article was a very detailed, impactful, stark reminder of the reality of that situation.
Well, thank you very much. I was actually moved to write this article after finishing a book by Sarah Chase, which is called Thieves of State.
Okay.
And she's an interesting woman. She was a reporter for NPR and ended up following the invasion of Afghanistan. She was actually embedded in with the troops and then ended up staying in Afghanistan and trying to do some work through NGOs and other means to try to improve the lives of ordinary people in that country. And as a result of her 7 or 8 years of working in Afghanistan, she came to have an analysis, an understanding of what was going on that was rooted in this whole concept of corruption, this idea that government at every single level, from the daily dealings that ordinary people have up to the highest level of the government in Afghanistan, and as she later learned, many other countries, is corrupt. And it's corrupt to the point that she actually called it a vertically integrated criminal enterprise.
Oh, absolutely.
Which basically sucked money from the bottom up. It was like one of those pyramids schemes or multi-level merchandising schemes like Mary Kay Cosmetics or something like that, where each person at their level buys the right to have their position, and then they have to continue paying the money they extract from the people below them on up to the very top of the pyramid, where it lands in the hands in Afghanistan, in the Karzai brothers' hands.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And instead of Steve Buscemi on the New Jersey Atlantic City boardwalk, it's Karzai in Afghanistan.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly.
And I thought it was really beautiful how you then tied that into the state of corruption in the United States, all the way from the local level of the police to the highest levels of Dick Cheney and the military-industrial complex.
Exactly. And what you were saying before, the fact that we don't call this corruption is, I think, the point that I was trying to make in the article, that that once having Sarah Chase's lens, I could then turn it and look again at my own country and say, wow, we have exactly the same thing going on here. And it's no wonder that just as in Nigeria and in Afghanistan and in other countries that are very high on the corruption perception index, as they call it, that here in the U.S., people would become weary and contemptuous and not believe in the possibility of clean government. And one of the things that she points out is that when that happens, people, first of all, are completely driven out of the democratic process.
That's right.
But they also tend to turn and look for some other form of governance, some other way of running things that will be less corrupt. Yeah. And in many cases, what that means is they turn to, in the Muslim world, something like the promise of Sharia law.
Which ideological purity, as they call it.
Yes, which takes the concept of the ulema, the community, the Muslim community, and says we can have really a paradise on earth if we run our community according to these pure laws. Mm-hmm. In the United States, we see a similar thing, a call to return to God's law in the form of the Bible, right?
Right. Right.
That's governed by Leviticus and the Ten Commandments.
And it's amazing how much crossover there is between those two. It's almost scary to think, you know, these warring factions in terms of a lot of Islamic Sharia extremism and the extreme evangelical bent from the Christian side, and it's a lot of the same stuff, ideological purity tests, the control of women, the the control of women's reproductive rights.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah. But, it's interesting, and while I really, really enjoyed the article, obviously, and it's a very important article at all, it also had a sort of depressing and chilling feeling reading it, because the entire point of why we do this podcast and a lot of our activism is in terms of trying to get the younger generation more politically involved. And we see this dichotomy all the time, where poll after poll says that really progressive ideals are much more in the mainstream of the American consciousness in terms of what Americans say they want, and in terms of how those attitudes are changing and becoming more progressive, as the younger generation gets larger in numbers. The problem is, of course, they are also much less politically active. They don't vote in the numbers of a lot of the older folks. So the problem is, I encounter a lot of my peers will either know or read something like your peers and your piece on the corruption, and sort of throw up their hands and say, see, the game is rigged. Why should I even bother?
Exactly.
So,
go ahead. Let me talk a little bit about Ferguson, because I think Ferguson is a very encouraging example.
Okay.
So one of the things that I talk about in the article is that this corruption is not only at the national level, but ordinary, especially very poor people experience it in their daily lives. And after Michael Brown was killed by the police in Ferguson in 2014, the U.S. Justice Department actually did a report on the police department of Ferguson.
Right.
And what they discovered is that the police department there is essentially a revenue-generating operation.
Yeah, it's a mafia.
And they shake down
all the residents with bogus tickets and court appearances and license revocations and everything else to bilk all the money out of these folks. Absolutely.
But what I want to say is, we wouldn't even know that any of that was true if it were not for the activists who were thrust into action by Black Lives Matter, who got out in the streets and demanded, first they demanded, that someone be held accountable for Michael Brown's death, but then they went on to demand that there be an investigation into the reality of life in Ferguson. And as a result of that activism of those young people, because they are mostly young people, I actually know Alicia Garza, who is one of the three founders of Black Lives Matter. Mm. And she's young-ish, okay, definitely Gen Y. But she and her two fellow queer black women activists who started Black Lives Matter have a long history of community-based organizing. So they didn't just walk into this out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And they galvanized through new methods, including social media, something that until I saw what Black Lives Matter did in Ferguson, I'll admit that as a longtime on-the-ground kind of organizer, which is what I used to do before I got into this academic gig, I was a little skeptical about what you could do in a world that appeared to be entirely in the ether. But now I've seen that that power of getting people out on the streets has actually led to beginning to expose, and then Ferguson turns out not to be the only place at all. And
what I was going to say is that, you know, I wonder if we have to wonder how many other places are exactly the same and that we just don't know because there hasn't been an investigation. You know, Ferguson's not going to be an isolated example of this level of corruption with the police force and the courts and all of that. So I think it's a stark reminder that we should probably be looking into this in many, many communities.
Well, look at Chicago.
Oh my gosh, yes.
The lid is starting to get blown off Chicago, and I think they had cover for a long time because the mayor is Rahm Emanuel, and he's technically a Democrat, and he worked in the Obama administration, but he is as corrupt as any of them.
Absolutely. And when you talk about corruption in Chicago, you're really talking over the decades of
the
Democratic,
yeah.
A Democratic Party machine.
Sure.
I mean, that's the Daily Machine.
The Daily Machine. And you know, you could argue they helped Kennedy get in the White House. And, there's Blagojevich, who was in Illinois. And, it's sort of a political cesspool in the entire state almost.
Unfortunately, that is absolutely true. Yeah. But, again, you know, there are longtime activists and new activists in Chicago who are really organizing and fighting back. And we've seen they've forced Rahm Emanuel this morning to announce that he's firing the police chief.
Right. He really needs to fire himself, but that at least
is
a good start.
Right. But, we have to claim our victories.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
This is a problem on the left, I think, in general. And I would say, actually, it's more of a problem among people of my age, almost, or people about 20 years younger than I am, who have fought so hard to be able to understand that the United States is not the city on the hill that they were taught in grade school that it is, and have come to that hard-won understanding of the role, the powerful role the U.S. plays in international politics and the corruption here, and then it becomes almost impossible to recognize when we actually have a victory.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I sort of take a more maybe positive approach to that and say, well, if you want the United States to be that shining city on a hill that you were taught or that we should aspire to be, then we need to get more involved. We can't just sit back and call it business as usual and let these kind of things go on. And this gets into the dichotomy of the battle of right versus left is, you know, how dare you criticize the motherland because America can do no wrong and you're always blaming America. And it's like, well, maybe there's problems that, you know, we can do better and we can root out and we can improve upon to be more closer to that example we want it to be.
To the point earlier, you know, we need to name what's wrong and we need to be honest about it instead of sort of glossing over it or, you know, to name what the problem is.
Exactly. And I also think that this claiming of victories is going to give us the kind of momentum that we need. And also, if we really hated this country, we would leave.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We'd go somewhere, those of us who can afford to, those of us who have the option. And that, you know, to people who say, well, you're part of the Hate America First crowd, no, what we hate is a corrupt government, not a country which is an extraordinary amalgam of 300 plus million people who have the potential to do amazing things.
Sure. Or worse yet, we could get sucked into, a sort of extremism that is reactionary to this sort of thing. But we don't. We do a podcast to get young people involved in the political process. We're not encouraging them to take up arms or become any variety of extremists. You know, we do believe that democracy can work. It may not be working so well right now, but it can. And yes, there are elements that are working very hard to try to undermine that, of course, with the, you know, the gutting of the Voting Rights Act by the Supreme Court and a lot of the
Citizens United, I think.
Yes, the Citizens United and voter ID laws, but it's still within our power to try to reclaim some of that lost ground.
I think that's true. And I think, interestingly enough, I think in some ways the most important work that we have to do in the electoral arena in the next 4 years is actually at the level of our local governments.
Absolutely.
State legislatures. And here's a sort of wonky reason why, which is that in 2020 will be the next national census.
Right.
Yeah.
And after the census, in every state comes reapportionment, right?
Yeah.
It's the point at which they decide all over again how many representatives each state has to the Congress, but more importantly, within each state, the district lines get redrawn by the state legislatures.
Right.
And one of the things we've seen in the last decade is Republican gerrymandering over the country.
That's right. We have the potential to undo a lot of that gerrymandering, but not unless we can take back or at least shift the balance of power in a lot of these state houses and at the local levels.
And the good news about that is that statewide elections, although they are expensive, and I live in California where they are very expensive.
Oh, yes.
They still are not as expensive as federal elections, and you still have the opportunity to actually affect what happens because you're playing in a slightly smaller arena. It actually means that you can see your effects and you can measure them much more clearly when you're playing in a statewide or count or even county level arena. And the county is important too, because it's from those county and city offices that the candidates emerge who then eventually go on to be in the state legislatures. And we really, now is the time for us to be thinking about who, you know, who are the incumbents that we want to hold on to and who are the new, the new blood that we want to bring in. And I think, you know, difficult and scary as these times are, I also think they're a time of tremendous opportunity.
Well, that's a great topic for a segue, and I'm going to turn it over to Rachel to sort of explain the makeup of our state, Colorado. I just moved here about a year and a half ago. Rachel is a Colorado native, and it's sort of the quintessential purple state, and Rachel, maybe you want to expand on that a little bit and what we're trying to do here.
Yeah, so Travis and I are always yelling and screaming about local politics because we really believe passionately that that's where change has to start, particularly among young people. But Colorado is a really interesting state in that it is really purple. There's some cities and counties that are very right-leaning, including Colorado Springs. And
Jefferson County,
West. County.
Yeah.
And then there's some that are really blue. So Boulder, Denver, we have a lot of rural areas in Colorado, farming and ranching, and those areas tend to be less populated, but also they tend to lean much more red. And then our urban areas, which are obviously highly populated, tend to lean much more blue. So as a result, we're very much a swing state. Although recently we have the Democrats have won many, many victories in this state. We have a Democratic governor. We have a control of the state House and Senate.
Yeah, we did lose the Senate seat though, and the
we
House
did.
Seat. Yeah.
Yes, I know.
Yeah, yeah. But in terms of like local politics, we really have been leaning much more blue, which is heartening for us. And even in my county, Jefferson County, we just won a really important school board election.
Yes.
Which was tremendous.
Where young people, even before voting age, got very involved in that process, which is very,
very
heartening to see.
Yeah.
I've worked with young people who are too young to vote on issue campaigns in California. I worked with an organization called Californians for Justice. And there is nothing like opening your door to a young person who says, I can't vote, will you vote for me, to engage voters. It's really powerful.
That's amazing.
And yeah, that's something we want to get more involved in here. We're also thinking of trying to put together an actual campaign of some sort that may be in the works down the line.
Huh.
But we'll discuss that further as we go on here. One thing in terms, and this sticks in my craw, and it's not even necessarily my place to say, but I've been very frustrated as I've gotten more and more politically active over the last several years of encountering young women who really don't understand the lengths to which government is intruding more and more on their reproductive rights. To very extreme levels, and they don't seem to grasp what is at stake here and what's already happened in terms of restricting their reproductive rights and where it's going if they don't get more involved. And yeah. I'm gonna turn it over to you guys to discuss it, because it's obviously not my forum personally.
Well, except it is if you happen to be sexually active with women.
No, absolutely. No, right. In that sense, it absolutely is.
And that's something we talk about a lot, too, is that reproductive rights is not just a women's issue. It's every person issue. And young men, exactly. We talked about this on the last podcast, you know, how many young men who are yelling and screaming about being pro-life and abortion is terrible, and how many of them may not even know that they don't have a child currently that they may not want because of an abortion that they weren't aware of. So, and you know, birth control and all of that. I mean, it all is tied into at least heterosexual people.
Do you happen to know Renee Sherman?
I don't.
Okay, she is a young woman you need to know about. She is an African-American mixed-race woman, young, who is an abortion rights activist and who has bravely told her own abortion story in public and has called for women to actively speak up and acknowledge the secret that, millions and millions of us have actually had abortions and are afraid to say so. She's just gotten a job with NARAL in Washington, D.C. Before that, she was in journalism school at Cornell. And she's just a brilliant young activist and would be a great person for you to have on the show.
Great.
That would be amazing. We'll reach out for sure. There was definitely, I saw a hashtag on Twitter that I thought was really great. Hashtag shout your abortion. I think Lindy West started it. And so a lot of young people, a lot of women of all ages came out and shared their abortion stories. I even heard one woman who interviewed her mother, who was in her 70s, who had an abortion before it was legal, and sort of the horror of that. I think it's been really powerful as a way of women, you know, because we always talk about abortions being terrible and you know, rape and incest and all these extreme cases. But really, we need to be talking about the fact that we don't need forced motherhood, and women have the right to have an abortion for any reason that they don't need a reason. They don't need to explain it. It doesn't have to be a terrible situation. If you don't want to have a child, you have that right.
If I could just add a few things to this, I recently moved from Texas, and I moved just at the time when Wendy Davis had done her, you know, her filibuster, and she got a lot of people excited and motivated. And then unfortunately she didn't make any headway in the governor's race and was beaten soundly, and that was very depressing. But also, by the same token, I think that, and the media does a terrible job of this, that a lot of these quote pro-life activists need to be called to task, while at the same time they want to outlaw any and all type of abortion, even going past what is actually considered an abortion into accepted methods of contraception that they like to call abortion, and yet they're fighting just as hard to eliminate sex education and to make it more difficult to acquire contraception. It becomes really obvious and plain in that sense that it's not about the life of the unborn at all. It's about controlling women's reproductive health.
Right.
And it's about controlling
women's sexuality.
Yes, absolutely. Yep. And so to that end, again, it's very frustrating. I've encountered a lot of young women either having recently entered voting age or having been of voting age for many years, And they just sort of shrug and say, I'm not into politics. And I'm like, well, I'm sure you're into controlling your own reproductive health and your body and your own decisions. And you need to be aware. If you're gonna understand all that and then decide you still don't want to be involved in the political process, okay, I think that's a little crazy personally. But it's very stunning and frightening to me. And I know we've talked about how this is an issue that men need to be involved in as well, and can't be so glib about just passing it off. But there are so many women of voting age and obviously, potential reproductive age that need to understand what is happening and what is at stake. And already we are seeing in Texas, we're seeing the rise of secret and back alley abortions and people yep. going over the border into Mexico. And it's happening now.
As they did when I was young. I have another friend, a wonderful woman, Emily Whitehurst, who is a vice president of Planned Parenthood Texas, mm-hmm. who has just taken on this job and I think is incredibly brave to do it. I mean, you know, physically brave, really, because people are risking their lives now to provide these services, as yes. we have seen.
And it's horrifying that we have to go back here, you know. And I'm sorry, go ahead, Dr.
No, I was going to say, when there are people who say I'm not interested in politics or I don't want to do politics, I think it's helpful for us as people who wish they would to probe a little further and find out why not.
Sure.
Because sometimes the answer is, you know, I have a personal solution. I'm convinced that everything's going to work for me and I don't care. But sometimes the answer is I can't even imagine how I would begin. I wouldn't
That's
know
exactly
where to
right.
insert myself.
Yep, I don't understand. It's overwhelming and I don't know. And so I'm just not going to try. Or it's so sad and it's so out of my control that I just feel like putting my hands in the air and saying, there's nothing I can do.
Right.
We have a lot of people in my life that are sort of apolitical that I work very hard to try to sort of explain the issues. And when it comes around voting time and election season, they come to me and they say, I don't really know. I don't really know what's going on. Explain this to me, and we work really hard to do that in a way that is not elitist or anything.
Or condescending, which right? it's easy to fall into that trap.
Yeah.
But that's a really great point. And I have a friend and activist who I grew up with. She's down in Virginia. Her name is Molly Vick, and she actually appeared on the cover of the Washington Post because she had made this great T-shirt when there was a lot going on there under Governor McDonald, who's now headed mm-hmm. to prison.
Yes.
And there was a great movement in Virginia, and it's really swung the electorate there, which was considered probably a leaning red, maybe purple state, to turning almost solidly blue because people like her were able to get so many young people and young women involved in the process.
And that was the movement about ultrasounds, right?
That was the start of it. There's more than that, but that was the main crux of it. So it can be done. It can be done with the right messaging and the right sort of outreach. But that's just one issue, and we could talk about, you know, reproductive rights and the battle, the looming battle, certainly if the Supreme Court goes a certain way, over Roe v. Wade. But maybe shifting a little bit now to recently, obviously, what happened in Paris and the new sort of wave of Islamophobia and the refugee crisis. I think the other side is going to very extreme lengths in their rhetoric to the point where they're almost investing a lot of almost hope that there are going to be more Paris-style attacks to validate where they're going.
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. I think, you know, just as 9/11 was a gift in a sense to the national security state.
Yes.
This is the Paris attacks have given new life to a jingoist American, you know, a very particularly American style of anti-immigrant sentiment,
yes.
which we see repeatedly historically, and, you know, almost always historically, it's been people who have been perceived as not white.
Sure.
Whether it was the Irish, who at that time were not considered white,
right,
or it was people from Southern Europe like Italians, or the Chinese with the Chinese Exclusion Act, and now...
And always my people, the Jews.
yes, and mine, absolutely. My grandfather's name was Kordonsky.
Ah.
But at Ellis Island, they said, ah, that's too long, we'll shorten it to Gordon.
Right.
And then when I went to Scotland, people said, ah, Gordon, that's a fine Scots name. Well, it is, but I'm not.
There's a terrific book that I read recently called The History of White People by Nell Painter, which delves into that in great detail.
I highly
recommend it. Yeah, I don't think most people remember that Irish people weren't considered white, Italian people weren't considered white.
Oh, no, yeah.
That race is such a social construct.
Yeah, you have to go back to really the turn of the century, or maybe in more modern times, look at something like Martin Scorsese's The Gangs of New York to really understand how that was sort of mainstream Americana almost to a certain extent. And so there's a push for that now. And I feel like they're going way, way over the line, the Trumps and the Cruises.
I think so. When you get the New York Times coming as close as I've ever seen them to calling someone an out-and-out fascist with Donald Trump, I think it's possible they have overstepped. The scary thing is that there are enough people standing there happy to greet them on the other side.
Yes.
But I think it's possible they've overstepped. The thing that is just horrifying, though, is that it's happened at a time when I don't know how much you've been following the refugee crisis, but one of my
dear
friends.
Pretty closely, yeah.
Okay, so I have a very dear friend who's Lebanese who lives in Beirut. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they've already, in this very small country, absorbed over a million Syrian refugees.
Yeah, as has Jordan.
Which was already 65% Palestinian. And, you know, Turkey has a bunch. And there are the UN says that there are something like 4.5 million refugees outside the country.
Sure.
And another 8 million inside the country. And the whole country, that's basically 50% of the entire population of the country, has been thrown out of its home in one way or another as a result of this war. And so now we have winter coming on and people stuck in basically exposed to the elements in Europe and in Greece and in Turkey. And it is hellish. And for the United States at this point, which had already only said, you know, there are 4.5 million people.
And we're going to take something like 10,000. Yeah.
Right, exactly. So that's already tiny. And now we won't even take them.
No.
And
it's absurd.
The political will is I don't know if we're going to take anybody at this point.
It's going to be hard. I mean, I live in a state where the governor Jerry Brown said yes we will, but half the governors have said no, and I don't know if they even legally can.
No, they can. They can certainly gum up the works and effectively stop it.
Right.
Or slow it down.
What I was going to say about that, too, is that it's so hard because I think from a political perspective, it's such an easy vote, be it Democrat or Republican, to say, no, we're not going to take refugees. To just sort of, I think the general public is afraid and they don't really understand what's going on. And
no,
so
they don't.
Their representative can come back at election time and say, see, I did this. And not that many people are going to push back against them because they don't really understand the difference between ISIS and refugees, and it's scary.
No,
they
conflate it all with Islam, and then Islam, they conflate it all with ISIS and extremism.
Yeah. All one dark, foreign, scary mass.
Exactly.
And
that comes across in no uncertain terms with the rhetoric from the right, basically. And it's completely contradictory as well because, you know, these are folks that had been pushing for more military action in Syria and they want Assad out and they acknowledge there's a civil war that's driving millions of innocent people. But now those people are all potential terrorists because of what happened in Paris. And one of them apparently had a Syrian passport, which may have meant something. That mean all of a sudden all the Syrian refugees are potential terrorists, which is ridiculous, of course.
And, of course, we've been trained ever since – September 11th through a constant, really, campaign of fear-mongering to be afraid.
Sure.
I mean, you go to the airport, there's all this security theater. You take off your belt, you take off your shoes, mm-hmm. you put everything in a bin, and, you know, everything's in a baggie, and it has to be exactly this size.
Yeah, grandma's toenail clippers are
right.
keeping us
it's
safe. You know.
All theater. And it's all yes. designed essentially to convince us of something which is not true, which is that if you are willing to accept, on one hand, that people have to be tortured or have to be shot from the sky with drones, and on the other hand, that you have to accept any amount of surveillance the government wants to expose you to, the promise on the other end, which is a false promise, is that you will be completely secure, that you will never die.
You know, it's amazing. In the year, I think it was the year 2000, there was a movie, a major Hollywood movie called The Siege, and it was about Muslim terrorist, extremist terrorist attacks in New York City, and the whole themes around the movie were resorting to torture, Islamophobia, mm-hmm. having the military basically take over and destroy habeas corpus. And it's amazing how much of that turned into real life, and people sort of just forgot that it was a movie because we had to deal with the real life situation
of
9/11 a year later. And it was strikingly prophetic. It almost, you know, in that sense, like the movie in the 1970s Network about
right.
Yeah.
Yep. Network.
It's a great movie. I showed Rachel. She's
she's wonderful.
It's now, but it's amazing how sort of life sadly imitated art, and we didn't sort of absorb that.
and I think the other thing too that we have to remember is how sometimes art and Hollywood in particular becomes a mouthpiece for the government. So
it can.
You look at like the show 24, for example,
right.
or Zero Dark 30, or those kind of things that really are just propaganda films for the government's perspective.
They
gave the Zero Dark 30, the makers of that film were given exclusive access by the CIA to information so that they would make a specific narrative of what happened with Osama bin Laden in order for people to sort of accept it. And I think it's grotesque, but I also don't think people realize that goes on.
Sure.
Side, which is life imitating art. So that at Guantanamo, early on, they actually were watching 24 in order to try to come up with more extreme methods of interrogation.
Which is so asinine on so many
because,
levels.
Because they – here's the thing. They were being pressured to produce so-called intelligence demonstrating a link between the people who did 9/11 and Saddam Hussein in order to provide a pretext – for the invasion of Iraq. And so the torture project all began with this desire to have some way of demonstrating a link that didn't exist between Saddam Hussein in Iraq and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. And the link never existed, but they tortured people into saying it did.
And we still have people at Guantanamo that have never been charged, that there's absolutely no evidence. And they're just stuck in you know, perpetual limbo. And you know, everybody sort of shrugged and moved on, except for when, you know, some of the Republicans in Congress scream, you know, not to close Guantanamo because they don't want them in their city or whatever.
Republicans and Democrats, by the way.
And Democrats, that's
and
true.
And Democrats, absolutely.
That is fair to point that out, yeah. And it's also fair to point out that 40-something Democratic members of Congress signed on to stopping Syrian refugees as well.
Yep.
In a very knee-jerk move of cowardice.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope – we can hope that they received a lot of – I mean they received certainly a lot of – angry letters and correspondence from us and people like us, but it remains to be seen if they'll get primaried or you know, what have you.
Right, exactly.
In a perfect world where all us young progressive types were more politically involved, they certainly would, but we'll see.
Yeah.
So these are all such important issues. You know, I think as I told you before we started that torture has been one of my issues, and part of the reason I started to think and write about it immediately after September 11th was because it became clear almost immediately that whatever else we did, that was going to be part of the U.S. response. We began seeing in the media, in Newsweek, in November of 2001, there was an article, an op-ed piece by a guy named Jonathan Alter.
Yeah,
who is
love Jonathan Alter.
Yeah. So he wrote a piece called Time to Think About Torture.
Jeez.
In which he said, you know, the FBI has rounded up all these people to try to interrogate them about 9/11, and they're not talking. So we need to think about, he says, anybody who thinks we have to follow the old rules is living in a hopelessly September 10th world. Oh, I think he probably regrets that piece more than anything he ever wrote in his life, especially because the people he was talking about torturing were actually the 600 Muslims living in the United States that were rounded up immediately after September 11th and taken to a jail in Brooklyn, New York, where they were held incommunicado for 6 months, were beaten and tortured, raped in one case at least with a police flashlight, and exposed to freezing cold and the, you know, stress positions, the whole stuff that we then got used to seeing. Not one of them had anything to do with September 11th. Not one of them had anything to do with any kind of terrorism whatsoever. If this had happened to people in the 80s in Latin America, we would have said they'd been disappeared.
Sure. Yeah.
And these were the people that Alter was saying needed to be tortured because they weren't giving up what they knew, because
which is nothing.
Know anything.
Well, you know, that's interesting, and it just shows how very intelligent, educated people who should know better can succumb to knee-jerk fear reactions. I have to believe that Jonathan Alter probably wishes that he could take that article out of existence. So do a lot of people who wrote, except for, I guess, Judith Miller, who still stands
her. She still stands
her
by
lunacy.
Her stuff, but she's crazy.
Yeah, she's nuts. but, you know, at the very least, I do take some solace in the fact that when Fox News parades around Dick Cheney as if he's an American hero, and you still have something like 80% of Americans who think he's the scum of the earth, that, you know, at least most people see through the drivel. But, I mean, they're easily swayed back by fear, like they did a lot of knee-jerk polls just while they were still cleaning up the rubble and counting the bodies in Paris to, you know, what do you think of the refugees? And then, not a crazy majority, granted, but a majority of Americans were like, no, we should, you know, stop the refugees because they could be terrorists. Well, let's see what happens a few months from now, and people are more worried about the price of beans again. But the reactionary position to terrorism – it's a powerful, political thing. And, you know, obviously one party is taking full advantage of it. And I was at least heartened. And, Rachel, I don't know if you remember if you did this with me, but wasn't it the day after the Paris attacks, there was a Democratic presidential debate? And thank God it was the Democratic debate, not the other one. God only knows what we have seen then.
Really?
Deutschland über alles. But, the Democrats could have easily gone that way, or at least one of them. And they held their moral ground and said –
Even Hillary.
We still have a responsibility to accept refugees, and we can't overreact, and we can't engage in Islamophobia. And it would have been very, very easy for at least one of them to sort of ride the fear-mongering populist wave, and they didn't. And that may have been a purely political calculation, but it was still the right answer.
Well, and the fact that that was the right political calculation suggests that they are responding to the reality that there is a constituency out there for something besides just fear.
Yes.
And, you know, I was joking before about the actual title of my book, but the reason I wanted to call it A Nation of Cowards is because – precisely, I think we have developed a habit of being afraid. Yes. And, you know, this is the philosopher's side of me now, I believe that there are actually habits of character, and we can call them virtues, we can call them vices, but that the more you do brave things, the easier it is to be brave. The more you let fear rule you, the easier it is to let fear rule you. And the government, you know, the playing on our fear has developed in us over time the idea, the belief that it is absolutely possible and desirable that anything happen in order to ensure my personal survival.
Doesn't that speak to what the modern incarnation of what's considered patriotism from a progressive or even a moderate standpoint, and what a modern conservative considers patriotism? Because what a modern conservative seems to consider patriotism in this day and age is just simply might.
Might and self-interest.
Might and self-interest, whereas from a progressive standpoint, at least from my personal standpoint, I think that the Bill of Rights means something, and the writ of habeas corpus, and adhering to the Geneva Conventions, and the idea that at one time at least we didn't, or maybe one day in the future, we do not or will not torture our prisoners.
And also caring for the marginalized and the people of this country. That's what being a patriot is to me, is caring about everybody in the country. Even people who don't look like you or share the same, you know, zip code, or especially marginalized people. For me, people of color, LGBT people, women, poor people.
Right. And making structural changes so that people are no longer marginalized.
Exactly.
Which I think is, you know, it's not just caring for them, but creating the situation in which people don't have to live without housing. People don't have to live on $2 a day in the United States.
You know,
people don't have to be terrorized by their local police force.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
And your writing, Professor Gordon, really goes to the heart of what I was most disgusted and disheartened and frustrated by in the years after – in the years of the G.W. Bush administration, basically, when really those voices – and they were out there, but the voices of this reason and to hold these American ideals that they should still mean something, and this is why we're patriotic and this is what we're actually fighting for, were so drowned out by the din of you know, quote, national security. And you have men like Dick Cheney saying, no, torture is okay because it's in our interest. And I think for the most part, America has come around to realizing that that wasn't good. That wasn't right. And you know, they're trying to bring that back up, and they're trying to trot out Dick Cheney again. And you look at Jeb Bush, who fortunately doesn't look like he has much of a campaign, but he basically retained his whole brother's national security team. It's the same drumbeat.
Yep. It's the same people.
And you know, that's not even selling on the Republican side, let alone for a national electorate. So I guess there are some – you know, we cover a lot of the garbage that spews out of Trump's mouth and Cruz's mouth. And Bobby Jindal, who's no longer even a candidate's mouth.
Yes, thank goodness.
And it gets very depressing. But, you know, I have to believe that the majority of the American people just aren't going to buy it. And we can do better than that. Now, that said, I am cynical and darkly realistic in the sense that if we – over these next few months and into next year, if we do see a series of similar attacks, especially if there's a big domestic attack where, God forbid, many Americans died, that side's it's probably going to win.
No, I think that's absolutely true. I think – and so we can only hope for all kinds of reasons that it not happen. But I think you're right that something like that on American soil would – push us over the edge. Now, it's so interesting that somebody can shoot up a Planned Parenthood office and, you know, engage in an act of Christian terrorism.
Yeah,
exactly right.
That's an hour's drive from where we are. It's right in our backyard, basically.
Yeah. And, you know, the other day, my 90-year-old housemate, she's the daughter of one of my other housemates, fell, and we ended up having to transport her to the emergency room via an ambulance. And the EMT was this lovely woman, and she said, you know, we can't take you to St. Luke's, which is the nearest hospital. And I said, oh, why not? And she said, well, I guess I can tell you because it's all over the internet, but there's an active shooter at St. Luke's right now.
Oh, God.
I said, that's what the helicopters in my neighborhood have been about. She said, yes. And then she said, this was this sweet, young, blonde woman, extremely proper, I think possibly Dutch and not even American. And she actually, this is a podcast, so I don't know whether I can repeat the words that she said.
But you can't. Say whatever you like.
So what she said is, and I was shocked to hear this coming out of her mouth. There has been a fucking active shooter incident every single day of this year somewhere in this country.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I think it's something like so far, or in the month of November, between 70 and 75 children were killed in gun-related either accidents or shootings. If 70 kids died tomorrow in a terrorist attack, we would probably basically scrap the Constitution.
Exactly.
And start over with some sort of police state.
Right.
Yet the thousands and thousands of Americans who die at the hands of firearms each year goes unchecked and untouched, despite the fact that even something like 90% of gun owners want some common sense gun legislation. So it's really bizarre how screwed up our priorities are.
I read a statistic the other day that said, not a statistic, but a fact, which is we're on day 344 of this year, and there have been 351 shootings, mass shooting.
Yeah,
so that's
mass
more than
shootings.
Per day. Mass
right,
shootings.
That's what she was saying, mass shootings. I mean,
yeah.
It's, you know, and yet here we are doing all kinds of things, violating all of the basic principles of the country, not to mention many national and international laws, to keep ourselves, quote, safe. And it's so interesting that different kinds of danger carry different power in people's imagination.
That's right. It's psychological. It's why people are terrified. Some people are still very terrified to get on an airplane when your chance of dying or even being injured in an airplane accident are well beyond winning the lottery. But everybody hops in their car every day, and you know, tens of thousands of people die every year in car accidents. It's the illusion of control.
Right.
It's so interesting that we're not afraid of white gun owning men.
Right.
And
well,
that
I am.
I mean, I am too. But these are the persons
but I know what you
more
mean.
Likely to be murdered by than any yes. other demographic, and yet we exactly. just oh well, I guess it's just a lone gunman, and he's a weirdo, and it's probably mental health. It's crazy to me.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
Well, yeah, and I wrote I've written several articles about this. I wrote one in Daily Kos that was on the front page last week about how, you know, the FBI broke up a couple of crazy white supremacists had a terror plot to blow up synagogues and churches in Virginia. And fortunately, that got but you didn't hear anything about that on the news.
No.
You know, had it
no.
have been a
no.
couple Muslim guys that wanted to blow
right.
up a church, it would have been plastered all over the place. And in fact, when I lived in Miami, there was a group called, I think it was the Liberty City Seven, who were basically set up in the most ridiculous way. I mean, these guys didn't have two nickels to rub together.
Right.
And they were virtually homeless. And these undercover guys say, well, you guys want some bombs and guns and blow up the government?
Yep.
And they basically went
yep.
along with it. And they were painted yep. as Al-Qaeda syndicate terrorists. And, you know, these guys were basically potheads.
Thing yeah. with the people in Lackawanna up mm-hmm. by Buffalo. Yeah, no, it's a – unfortunately, that form of entrapment has been a big part of the FBI's modus operandi since September 11th.
Sure, but the point was the Liberty City Seven, these were all, you know, black guys with dreadlocks basically.
Right.
And Alberto
right.
Alberto Gonzalez and the FBI paraded them in front of everybody and say, haha, look, yeah. we caught these dangerous terrorists. And then, you know, Rush Limbaugh and Laura Ingraham went off the reservation saying how great it was that we stopped these dangerous terrorists. But yet, you know, these jokers in Virginia or this guy in Planned Parenthood, we're not going to call them terrorists. And it's pretty right. it's pretty obvious the reasons why. And
yes.
the thinking behind why. So,
yeah.
So there you have it. You're safe from the women and children that are fleeing Syria, and probably don't even own any firearms whatsoever
to begin with, right?
Yeah. And that's another thing I wanted to go. I know I've been rambling a little bit, but if you wanted to be completely cynical and look at it just from a security angle and not a humanitarian angle, it's very, very short-sighted to slam the door on poor, hungry, desperate people fleeing a war zone.
Yep.
And, you know, a lot of these terrorist groups, ISIS hasn't come around to this yet, they might, that if you are able to provide some sort of relief or humanitarian assistance to these people, they're going to be more sympathetic to your cause.
Oh.
Hamas does a tremendous job of this in
Absolutely.
Places like Beirut and in the West Bank. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, they're being –
Hamas more in the West Bank. I think you
yeah.
mean Hezbollah in Beirut.
Hezbollah. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
And guess what? Now you're talking about real potential converts, because the people that are feeding them and giving them shelter, even if they were initially the people that were bombing them out of their home, are providing some sort of relief, where the United States is slamming the door in your face, calling you a terrorist and saying, we don't want you.
And well, bringing it back to corruption.
Right.
They are the people who are offering, even if it is a violent and and strict government are offering the illusion, at least, of something that is pure and uncorrupt
and secure
in a world mm-hmm. in a world that is very dangerous and corrupt.
It's the same thing we used to talk about with gangs in the 90s, you know, that these kids that join gangs, it's not because they want to necessarily, and it's not because it's a glorious life, but it's a way to have a sense of community, be provided for, and be safe. And to,
respect.
To have some
respect.
Kind of promise
Family.
Of security and safety in a place that's really dangerous.
Yeah. And I think that Travis is right, that respect is really important.
Yeah.
I think in some ways it's even more than the loss of money is the sense of not being treated with the respect that's due to a human being that
right.
makes corruption so infuriating to people.
Yes. Yes.
And, you know, fortunately, you folks are working with a demographic that, I mean, these are my students. These are the folks I love. And if there's one thing that my students have, it is respect for other human beings in just amazing ways. And it's very encouraging to me. They have sort of, and USF is an interesting place because we are over half young people of color in our student body. One-third of the freshman year for the last 2 years have been first-generation college goers.
Wow.
And these folks have an instinctive sense that they know that there are things wrong with the world and that they want something to do with fixing it. And part of what I try to do in my class is give them some sort of theoretical tools for analyzing their world and thinking about ways that they could be involved. We study philosophy, and then they also work in a local community-based organization over the course of the semester, and it gives them a chance to kind of put some of the theoretical material into a genuine concrete context. And
wow.
The transformations that I see in students are just amazing.
Well, that's a good
that's
segue,
incredible.
as you would be considered in many ways a philosopher, and you may be teaching young philosophers. How come you didn't decide to get into welding? Because Marco Rubio insists that would have been a more prosperous vocation for you, but you didn't decide to go that way.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. I did actually look at the trades because I came up during the second wave of feminism,
mm-hmm.
and I was briefly a house painter.
Wow.
And learn from a union house painter, and I can still to this day enter a room and know exactly where to look to see the places where they missed when they painted the wall.
And there is nothing wrong or not respectable about being a house painter or a welder, let me add. And it's also ironic because, you know, Marco Rubio wants nothing to do with unions. And if there were still unions, you might be able to actually make a living being a welder or a house painter. Not so much anymore.
That is that what we need is welders who are also philosophers. We need people who, whatever it is, whatever their work, their vocation is, are also people who think it's important to examine the world they live in and attempt to understand it, to come to make what we call normative judgments, in other words, judgments of value, of right and wrong, about the world that they live in. And I think that one of the real effects of the 20th century on the nature of work has been to separate the brain work from the body work. And
mm-hmm.
this was done intentionally.
Absolutely.
According to something called the Principles of Scientific Management. Frederick Taylor wrote the book in 1907, but it essentially, the idea is that there should be a small group of people who are managers and they should use their brains and everybody else should just be cogs in the machine.
Well, that's kind of how it worked out, America. How do you like it? The Republicans want to double down on it.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So I want my welders to also be able to interrogate their world and say, why is it that I have so little when everybody else has, or when a few people have so much? Why is it that the police are terrorizing the people the next neighborhood over?
Mm-hmm.
What can I do about it? And I believe that the habits of thinking that you develop from doing philosophy, of logic, of argumentation, of learning to make your own arguments and disassemble other people's and understand how they work, I believe all of that is crucial to genuine democracy. That
I could not agree more. Yes, I love everything about that. And really, the only way that we're going to ever have that be a possibility is if we can properly educate everybody and not just the people who can afford it.
Sure. And it doesn't take a huge leap of logic to understand why an entrenched group of decision makers don't want that.
Nope.
And don't want a strong public education system at all.
Exactly.
Yeah. So this is what we're fighting for, people. It's your future. It's your children's future. It's all of our futures. We can be an actual part of a representative democracy, or we can be cogs in the wheel to make a few people rich.
Exactly.
That's where we are. And we've gone on a long time here, but I do want to pivot and talk a little bit about the current state of politics. We're not going to press you necessarily for who you're necessarily endorsing
an
for president.
We
are Bernie supporters, but we are not the kind of Bernie supporters who cast Hillary Clinton as the devil incarnate.
Mm-hmm.
I think we like Hillary a lot too. I think we come more from an understanding where folks like the Clintons and Barack Obama, to an extent, have sort of felt that they can accomplish the most they can within the framework of inequity and the, you know, an oligarchy, and we would rather see it sort of burnt to the ground in that sense. But I understand both sides. And I think we're also realistic in understanding that we are going to caucus for Bernie. We're going to support Bernie. We're going to vote for Bernie. We hope Bernie has a ton of influence and carries that influence all the way to the DNC, but he's probably not going to be the guy. We can live with that. You know, it's not a zero-sum game for us. That's the Democratic side. The Republicans, I don't even know where to effing start. But I will say this. We've talked about this before, and I kind of want your take on this. I would rather it was maybe not even so much Trump, a Ben Carson or a Ted Cruz, because we would finally have the real debate for the very disparaging visions for this country. You know, What have Republicans complained about the last two elections? Well, John McCain wasn't a real conservative. Mitt Romney wasn't a real conservative. Okay. Well, how about you nominate somebody who denies evolution, who doesn't believe in the social safety net, who wants endless war in all places, who is you know, completely against women's reproductive rights? Let's have that argument. We're confident. And our side's going to win big. But more importantly, let's actually have that out once and for all, that real battle of these completely disparate views.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that, Professor Gordon?
Well, I tend to agree with you. I think I can't believe that the Republican National Committee isn't going to pull itself together and find some way to nominate Marco Rubio, who seems to be
the
closest. But I may be wrong. They may not be able to. Democracy in their party, they win out.
Exactly. That's the incredible irony, right? I mean, they're facing such stiff headwinds that anybody seen – and this is their own doing, of course. I mean, they created this monster.
They have cultivated this creation.
Right,
absolutely.
Right.
And it's coming home to bite them. But in terms of I think we're very much on the same page as far as the Democratic candidacy goes. I think that, you know, I actually probably dislike Hillary a little bit more than you do, but I am going to – actually, living in California, I don't even have to vote for her because she's going to win anyway.
Right.
But, of course, I will vote for her. And, yes, I think Bernie has actually and is actually playing a really important role. I have friends who live in Vermont who say he actually is the real deal. And you know how it is with any politician. The closer you are to them, the less perfect they are, as with any
of course, of course.
Yeah.
But so I think it would be an astonishing thing if we actually – I mean, I can't remember the last time we had a real conflicting debate between the parties for president. It might have been – Lyndon Johnson and Barry Goldwater.
Yeah, I was thinking that too. Yeah.
And even he came around after a while to think that he had perhaps overstretched a little bit.
Yeah. Even Goldwater thought he went too far, right?
Yeah.
And Lyndon Johnson probably, in a lot of ways, was much more moderate than a true liberal. But
and if it had not been for the war in Vietnam, one of the greatest presidents we ever had.
I completely agree. Yeah.
We got Civil Rights Act. We got the Voting Rights Act. We got the Great Society and the War on Poverty. Yep. And, you know, I lived in D.C. those years. I was I moved to D.C. when I was 9 years old. My mother got a job in the Peace Corps. And that's where I grew up, which was a fascinating place to grow up.
Were you there when Nixon came out to the steps of the Capitol to talk to the young
people? I wasn't actually there, but I was on the streets. I just wasn't right.
That's fantastic.
Well, you know, high school, I was busy. Not so much in class as a few other things.
Sure,
but
we were all there, yeah.
But, you know, in terms of the coming election, I was very sure that we were going to have another Bush-Clinton election.
I thought so,
and now
too.
It looks as though they have not been able to inflate the guy, and it's just not going to work.
He's not fire and brimstone enough for them. He doesn't hate refugees enough. He's not white supremacist enough. He's not, you know, raging super right-wing evangelical enough. They're spoiled. They want it all. They're not going to settle this time. At least it seems that way.
It seems that way. I think in the end that we'll get Rubio.
Well, Rubio is pushing. He is masquerading as being further extreme than he was. Now, are they going to forgive him that he was once part of the Gang of Eight and pushing for comprehensive immigration reform? A lot of them won't.
That's true.
And he's going to get clobbered for that in places like South Carolina and Georgia and Alabama. So, you know, we'll see.
It's going to be an interesting year. And, you know, I was in Aurora in 2008. I spent 3 weeks out there working for Obama.
Aurora, Colorado?
My
neighborhood.
Yeah, it was an amazing time to be there. And I think probably in some ways the most exciting election I've ever been part of, just because of the broad array of people who were in this one little office. Mm-hmm. We had everything from the wife of an Air Force guy who was stationed in Iraq to two high school students from Ethiopia who were absolutely fascinated when they found out that I had been in Nicaragua and said to me, "Wow, was that in the time of the Sandinistas?"
Yeah.
And I looked at them and said, "Where are you from?" You know, no U.S. high school students would have any idea what you
were talking about. No, they would have no idea.
And a bunch of middle-aged African-American women, and I will never forget the morning of the election, we sat down to a phone bank, and before we started making the calls, this woman turned to me and said, "I woke up in the middle of the night last night crying because a black man is going to be president of the United States."
Wow.
It was pretty incredible. I canvassed on Miami Beach, and it was interesting there too. The thought among most of us was somehow they're going to steal it. It's not going to happen. It's just too good to be true. And then, you know, we made it happen. The Obama presidency overall will be a mixed bag. I think history is going to look more kindly on a lot of his accomplishments than we realize right now.
I've just finished a new book called American Nuremberg, mm-hmm. which is about the crimes committed in the war on terror and who ought to be held responsible. And I agree with you. However, I also think that the drone war is a series of human rights crimes and, in some cases, war crimes. And we are not going to look kindly on
and
that.
And I hope you're right. And that should be a black mark on American foreign policy and the Obama administration. However, my fear is it could go the other way and it could be just seen as business as usual. I sure hope not, because then the country will have turned into something that's hard to recognize. But I'm in 100% agreement with this. And I get into these arguments all the time with conservatives where, you know, they say, well, you're an Obama sycophant. I'm like, no. There's a lot I don't like about his drone policy. There's some economic things I don't like. There's some foreign policy things I don't like. They're like, okay, but you voted for him. I'm like,
well, yeah.
Find six black marks next to the thousand for Mitt Romney, and it's still an easy choice.
Exactly.
But not that there aren't Obama sycophants out there who call themselves progressive and then find excuses for drone warfare and everything else. And those are the most frustrating people to deal with. But no, a true progressive is not a political sycophant for any representative or party. You know, we are educated and we hear the arguments from all sides. That's the whole point.
Right.
Yep. At least it should be.
It should be. Absolutely.
Yes.
Wow. Well,
Dr. Gordon, it's been great. It was really great talking to you. We would
this was a lot of fun.
We'd love to have you back on at some point if you're available.
I would love to.
It's an absolute pleasure.
Oh, thank you. Me too. Can you send me a link so that I can post a link to the podcast on my website?
Will do. Absolutely.
Would love that.
And,
yes.
And,
beautiful.
Since you have a little chance here, please, if you could plug your books and some recent articles.
Absolutely. So you can find a number of my articles on a variety of subjects at tomdispatch.com. And I've written there about the drug war in Mexico, about corruption, about torture. My book from Oxford University Press, Mainstreaming Torture, is very, very accessible, even though it's from an academic press, and it's about the ethics of torture after 9/11. My new book from Hot Books is coming out in March. It's called American Nuremberg, and it's about the crimes that have been committed in the U.S. war on terror and who should be held accountable for them.
Required reading for all Irreverent Testimony listeners. So,
and we'll post links to all of those things in the show notes.
Yes,
oh, that's wonderful. Thank you so much.
Of course, of course.
Thank you so much, Professor Gordon. It's been fantastic. We're going to be back, of course, very soon. I know we've been slacking a little this week. There's plenty to talk about. So expect some podcasts in the coming days. We're still preparing for our Supreme Court episode spectacular. Rachel's working very hard on that. We're going to have more guests coming up, of course. And so stay tuned. As usual, I have been Travis.
I'm Rachel.
Stay tuned, stay active, stay involved.